Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Things are going fine. You see, what happened was due to this cyber problems, we had loaded in. Normally, the roundtable theme would play, and then inadvertently, out of nowhere, the Midday Magazine theme played. And it's emblematic of all of the problems that are happening across this country. My poor brother, who is waiting in the airport now to go out, who had a 6 a.m. flight, maybe spending another night. I don't know. But hopefully anyone who is dealing with that will have,
good luck getting your luggage.
That's right.
I was assuming that the bumper music today would be Kid Rock, so I'm disappointed.
Yeah, well, and it was, and here's the reason why. We weren't sure when we had our morning meeting if the Trump speech was actually over yet. So we...
there are seven people still in Milwaukee.
Still going on. They're playing with the beach balls. They're going full steam ahead.
Stephen Miller and six others.
We have a lot to discuss this morning, obviously, and we will do so with a fantastic group. I just want to say I feel blessed every day, but we have just the greatest panelists in the world. This week has been, I think, just a wonderful example of how terrific all of our panelists are. They rise to the occasion. They come in. They are brilliant. They're very eclectic in their knowledge base, and they share it with us. And they volunteer all of that, and it's just absolutely lovely. And we love our volunteers. We love our panelists, and we thank them very, very much for doing this great service. It's obviously people are waiting to hear what you all have to say about what is going on in our world. Let me properly introduce everyone, and then we will get started. Former EPA Regional Administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, president of Beyond Plastics. Do I have some of that right?
No longer visiting.
Okay, you're there now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
It's been
excellent.
A long stay.
Yeah, all right. Well, good. Judith Eng, good morning.
Good
How
morning.
Are you?
I'm okay.
Okay.
I'm waiting for the last 3 weeks to be over. It's kind of wrecked our summer, right? Just with worry.
It's been a big chunk of summer that seems to be taken up with... agita.
3 weeks from last night. I think the Monday morning crew gets points for, the debate was Thursday night. The so-called speech was last night. We're sleep deprived.
Yep.
And Friday morning panel is where it's at.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're all here.
I'm all here, but I am here.
We welcome the CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan. Hello, Heather. How are you?
I'm good. It's a great day to be a horse. Not that I'm a horse, but my horses are really, really happy this morning.
It's a great day to be a horse.
Just nice and cool,
sure.
And the grass is wet when they, go out after breakfast. And so it was a very pleasant morning on the farm.
Do they like the speech?
They kind of tuned out. It was on in the barn because I leave radio on because I have this theory that it will keep predators out of the barn, although that didn't stop a predator from eating 11 of my 12 chickens earlier in the summer.
Oh,
so,
dear. Circle of life.
But I tried to watch. I got to a point where I'm like, I just have to go to bed. I can't watch this anymore. But
I thought it was interesting when the New York Times told us that this speech was officially longer than Bill Clinton's famous convention speech.
It was the longest in history.
Which got him onto the Tonight Show because it went on. That was a speech where he said, "And in conclusion," and the arena just erupted in cheers.
Joy.
Yeah.
This is before he was president. That's what got him.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. We welcome Teresa Bourgeois to the program, public policy and communications expert. Hello, Teresa. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And I just want to say, just because I love space flight, it's the 55th anniversary of the first Apollo moon landing, and they landed 55 years tomorrow is the anniversary, and amazing. And it was led by a Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute professor, George Lowe, and they are getting ready to go back to the moon this year, and led by another Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute person, Reid Weissman. So big time for space flight. I just find space flight amazing. So
well, it is amazing.
Isn't it incredible that they could land the way they did when
yes.
they did?
Yes, and it's also, I mean, besides the fact that it obviously was a soundstage in Hollywood, but yeah, I think it was great.
They had less than 20 seconds worth of fuel when they touched down.
Just amazing. Absolutely amazing.
It's just, and people came together. And anyway.
And good news to start us off with.
That's right. Just remember, we can all come together for a cause.
CEO of the Business Council of New York said, did I say hello?
Yeah, you did already
all right.
say hello.
That's all right. I changed scripts. I apologize. Aaron Pisidi is the gentleman we haven't introduced yet. Siena College professor of economics. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good morning.
Well, we'll take care of that. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. It's very nice to have you with us on this Friday morning, and a lot going on, of course. We'll have more information on the what is causing all the delays across the globe, of course, and as that becomes a bit more known as to what is going on. But in the meantime, let us talk about all that is happening in our world. Yesterday was the close of the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The former president of the United States, just days after being the target of an assassination attempt and being injured in that attempt, went before the party faithful last night and gave a speech that was billed as a speech that would be one of unity. It would be one of reflection in the face of almost losing his life. And I say this not to be funny, but just absolutely seriously, that lasted about 8 minutes. And then we went into what we would expect from a Trump speech, a Trump rally speech, I think. And even for some, very surprising that it went on as long as it did, and also that it was generally off the cuff, and which is the way he runs his rallies. And even all of these reports of him talking to his speechwriters and giving them, telling them what he wanted to say, and having them put it into the prompter. That did not work. There was one point where a reporter for the Times who was watching the prompter, was in the room, was watching the prompter in the speech, and he said, "Okay, the prompter has just stopped now, and he's riffing like this is
the John Coltrane of BS.
Yeah, this is just going on." So we'll see how long this lasted. It lasted over 12 minutes that particular before he went back to the next item. Anyway. So then the question is, a lot of pundits were saying, well, this was the president's chance, the former president's chance to say, look, I had this near brush with death, and I'm changed, and we need to come together, and it's time to come together, and these are the things that I'm going to do. But that didn't happen, and because it didn't happen, it then really reminded a lot of people what they are referring to as Trump amnesia, sort of forgetting what people went through from 2016 to 2020, that many pundits felt, oh, well, this will remind them of what they of what they went through during that period of time, and what exactly his vision, quote unquote, is for the future of the United States of America. Finally, this all comes as the current president of the United States, Joe Biden, seems to be inching closer to this idea of stepping out of leaving the race. He has not said that. He has not indicated that in any concrete way. However, we are getting the signs of he's more receptive to the idea. He is thinking about this in very stark terms. He's listening to those who are talking to him and understands the steep hill that he would have to climb if he continues in the race. Others around him say that that it's all but done, and it could come in a matter of hours or days, but it seems inevitable, which, of course, is only always just up to the President of the United States. And if he decides to change his mind, then we're back to where we were or where we are now and where we were 3 weeks ago. So with that preamble, I go to I guess I go to Judith Heng of your thoughts on the address last night by the former president.
Well, I thought the beginning was rather poignant. He needed to give this firsthand account of this horrible act of political violence. And I think people listened and they were respectful. And then after that, it went off the rails. It was kind of a decaffeinated version of his standard rally speeches. And you could tell when he was off the teleprompter, which was most of the speech. What I found most disturbing is whenever he would wander, he would come back to immigrant bashing.
Yeah.
And it was so unfortunate and so not factual. You know, he said that immigrants are responsible. I can't find in my notes, but over 100,000 deaths a year, not referring to fentanyl, but referring to people who are in this country. We heard the racism again when he talked about immigrants are taking away black jobs and, in his words, Hispanic jobs.
By the hundreds of thousands.
Right. And, you know, gee, like when he first said that during the debate, I really appreciated all of the posts on social media of surgeons saying, this is my black job, and members of Congress saying, this is my black job. The giant photos of him bleeding up on the stage, the cameras didn't go to that constantly, but a fair amount, even when he was past the first section of the speech. This was supposed to be the unity speech. He couldn't help but take a shot at Nancy Pelosi. And I think Pelosi is on his mind because, thank God, she is emerging as the person who is trying to navigate getting Biden to step aside.
The adult in the room.
Yeah. And, you know, really interesting. She is the Speaker Emeritus. And so Hakeem Jeffries can't play that role because he has to represent all the House Democrats. But she's playing that really important role.
But I think it's also poignant because she's playing that important role because she was a person who stepped aside.
Right.
Who said, it's time for a new chapter of leadership, and I'm going to turn this over. So it becomes even more poignant.
Yeah.
She's had to do it.
Yeah. I find my personal mood every day is heavily influenced by articles about what Nancy Pelosi is and isn't doing. And that is not a good place to be this summer. But, you know, I think the most important thing is last night's speech reminds us all that Trump is beatable if we have a Democrat who can effectively communicate. And our current president, with all due respect, is not effectively communicating. It's been 3 weeks now. You know, everyone knew we had to give him some time to process this and get through this. But time is up. We are getting dangerously close to not having time to put together an alternative candidate. So I think the speech last night was a bright spot for Democrats who needed to be reminded that Trump is not the juggernaut that he and his campaign want us to think he is.
I still can't believe that the introduction came from Kid Rock, Hulk Hogan, and the head of the UFC.
Yeah, that says a lot,
yeah. Doesn't it?
Yeah, and Kid Rock was lip syncing.
But you know what the remarkable thing about all three of those people are? I mean, maybe with the exception,
they're batterers. They've battered women.
They're has-beens. They're all people whose time has come. They had their celebrity. And now they're, it's just like the death gasp of trying to hold on to cultural relevance, kind of the same way Trump is doing. So it's perfectly fitting that those were the people that he chose to do that.
Maggie Haberman made that point about not so much what you were saying, but the even in the clip package when they were showing Trump's life, it was also the glory days of the 80s. It was going back in time to not anything that happened like in the last 25 or 30 years, but all of this heyday of the casinos and New York and reshaping all of that. Teresa, I'm going to go to a break, all right? And then we'll go to a break, and when we come back, I'll let you loose. You can go. By the way, I want to in full disclosure, all of you were scheduled to be here. Teresa said, "Can I please be on the day after the convention?"
Yay.
And I said, "Oh my God, yes." She goes, I'm just going to be talking to myself if I don't do this.
I think Teresa should be on every day.
Yes, well, she's amazing, and we're lucky to have her, and we'll have her thoughts and hear from Heather as well. We welcome your thoughts, panel at WAMC.org. We will return after this short break.
One taste of you. Just a taste of you will make me die the sweetest day. It's not a lie. A taste.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning. Just want to quickly note, we lost Bob Newhart yesterday at the age of 94, one of our great comedians. Bob Newhart was my idol. I thought of him as my dad played me his records when I was like four. And I think by the time I was six or seven, I knew everyone by heart. And I still do, I think. And so I about 2006, I interviewed him, and I worked really. We got a lot of archival tape, and did a nice job on the interview at the time. And we're going to play that in our 11 o'clock hour to remember him. It was very sad to hear of his passing. He lived an amazing life, and. Just is really one of the greats. He's one of those people that I so far in less than 24 hours, but I've not heard anyone say a bad thing about the guy. A class act, and a really wonderful, wonderful comedian, and wonderful father and husband and friend. And so we'll remember him coming up in our 11 o'clock hour. Right now, we're talking about the end of the Republican National Convention that took place last night, finishing up with a speech by the former president of the United States. This was the grand finale. Donald Trump took to the stage. Teresa, what do you think?
Well, I think they build this as people said, it's a unity convention and one of reflection. And in a way, not the way they planned it, became that. I mean, helped to unify their base. And it gave us all a chance to reflect on who Trump really is. And I think that through most of the convention, by all accounts from people there, it appeared watching it. It was very well run, very well orchestrated. And they were trying to remake Trump's image as a family man, remake Trump's image as a strong leader. And they were trying to have all of us forget about his actions, his policies, his court cases, certainly about his stand on abortion and so on and so forth. And they did that right up until the point when he started speaking. As you say, Judith, the first portion was quite moving. And political violence is certainly not acceptable. What happened to him and what happened to the people there was outrageous and shouldn't happen. But it's then when he veered off, and he doubled down on all of it. He doubled down on his resistance to a peaceful transfer of power. He reiterated his big lie over and over again. He doubled down on his, as you said, Judith, the racial issues when he went back again on black jobs. I mean, really, what's black jobs? And then tried to clean it up saying union jobs, but... he and There were so many lies. I think it broke the truth meter, right? Lies about and I noted that a lot of what he was reading was lies. He said it was going to be a new speech. It was his rally speech, right? He lied about his economic record, which we'll get to later. He lied about his foreign policy record. He lied about his domestic policies. He lied about most of it. But it's really up to the rest of us to make it clear that those are lies. We cannot let that what the picture they're trying to create, because in fact, and we were talking about this at the break, that even though it was long and rambling and disjointed and confusing in many, many parts, as some of the commentators said, that the campaign felt that they got the snippets that they needed, because most people will not be watching the speech. Most people will see this on social media. They'll see it in ads. And so it's up to the Democratic Party to remind people of who he really is and what he really stands for. The other part that I just want to say is this theme that they're leaning heavily into, there's been this underlying issue about how he's been sent by God to, somebody sent by God. And then last night it was all about how he was saved by God. And they lean very, very heavily throughout the 4 days in the saved by God. And I think that that will continue, because that tries to erase some of his really vile behavior, how he treats people, how he treats women, how he treats, workers, and so on and so forth. But again, it's up to the Democrats and the Republicans, who are never Trumpers, to remind people that was entertainment and not true, and help people remember what they experienced when he was in leadership and since then.
Heather.
Yeah, so I think the convention was really well done as far as trying to present or make the case that this is the big tent party. I actually heard someone say they did make that case. They had someone who was pro-choice speak at the convention. They had a labor leader speak at the convention. Very calculated in getting sort of the non-college educated voter appeal with Hulk Hogan and Kid Rock and, high entertainment value and all of those things. I think they very much accomplished making themselves look like the party that is very organized, very, they had clearly planned this out. And then, of course, the assassination attempt, and it's undeniable if you watch the video that it really was a stroke of luck that he moved his head when he did, because he actually, I've seen numerous analyses saying that if he had not moved his head, it absolutely would have killed him. So the beginning of the speech, I thought, was really well done also in terms of the reflection. And of course, they know his big problem is that people don't like him, right? He has these high negatives. So they tried to do a lot of things to humanize him and have, his granddaughter speak, and the stories about his granddaughter sitting on his lap, or the visual of his granddaughter sitting on his lap for part of the convention. All of those things were great. If people were watching, just, tried to stay up to watch the beginning to see if he was a different man, if you watched the first 10 minutes, you would say, well, yeah. It was very kind of emotional, and you could see people in the audience that were very emotional when he described, the events of the assassination attempt. And then, the wheels came off. He stopped reading the teleprompter, and you could actually tell when he stopped reading it. And he went back into very sort of predictable, all over the place stump speech. Bringing up sort of his gripes and his pet peeves and the points that that he's been reiterating that I think even his campaign staff wish he wouldn't. But the first 10 minutes are the part that most people would have stayed up to watch. And I mean, at some point, I also turned off the TV and went to bed. I'm like, okay, we're in Trump stump land. I don't need to see anymore. But, you know, on balance, they have momentum right now. I don't think that this hurt them, but I do think that the Trump nomination speech was sort of a missed opportunity. He could have stayed away from those things. Of course, everybody would have reminded us that he has all these holds all these beliefs and grudges. But if he had stayed away from them, it would be credible that he was somehow a changed and different person. And I think, you know, the reporting is going to illustrate sort of that. Yeah, he's still really the same old guy. But for the folks, you know, who were there, who are clearly his base, I mean, it's looking more and more like he's this sort of messianic figure. And that is, you know, a little unsettling.
It'll be appealing to some, but that's his base. Yeah. But they did try to rebrand him, but he is who he is.
Right. I liked the his name in lights. I felt like I was in Broadway.
That was
Trump Tower.
He's going to come out singing.
I thought the set was impressive when the podium comes up from the floor. And I thought it was very, very well orchestrated.
Well, I mean, the showmanship of it is,
and
I think we all can say
that
Trump is a showman.
And
so when you see him start the speech and the backdrop of the White House as if he's giving it in the Rose Garden is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But isn't
it look good?
A lot like Worldwide Wrestling, which is, you know, fake.
Yeah.
Right?
But people love it.
But it's fake.
But it's very
thank God he didn't pull off his shirt.
Yeah. So can I just say, look, I had this moment. I had a property professor in law school who on the first day of class came in with a button-down shirt on and ripped his shirt off at the beginning of class, and he had a Superman t-shirt on underneath. Mm-hmm. And that's like the instantly came to my mind when Hulk Hogan did that. I don't know.
That's disturbing.
I mean, it's really great.
After years of therapy, we've gotten over that.
Oh, he was a good professor, Professor Bomar. I didn't do great in that class, but I liked him.
Aaron.
Yeah, listening to his speech, it's tough to imagine a presidential candidate who has hated this country more than he appears to.
Hate or just feels that it is coming out of an apocalypse.
No, I think he legitimately hates the democratic norms and institutions that constrain behavior of narcissists like him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he wants to destroy that.
Of his ilk, as my mother would say.
Yeah. So, you know, it's the Democrats are creating this chaos. It's the immigrants that are, you know, murdering people at the border. And all of these lies just demonstrate a contempt for a lot of the things that make this country what it is. And that is functional national institutions run by career public servants. And he wants to dismantle that. So to me, that's somebody saying, I hate this country. I hate the way it's organized because it constrains the behavior of people like me and my ilk to do whatever they want. So that was my big takeaway.
And I know that this happened in the 2016 campaign and into his acceptance speech at the inauguration. But the laundry list of things that are going to happen on the first day.
Yeah.
Right. We heard that last night. This is on the first day we shut down the borders on the first day.
Raising the question, why didn't he do it during his first term? It's not like this is his first time running. He was president for 4 years and he didn't build the wall and he didn't build. But we heard last night the Iron Dome he's going to build.
The Iron Dome
over the country. You know, it's not his first tenure as president.
This might be a minority opinion, but I never. Knowing that he's a pathological liar and a narcissist, I don't think he cares whether he's president or not. I think he wants people to clap for him. I think he wants to see his name on stuff. Mm-hmm. So
needs to stay out of jail.
Talking about building the wall is not about immigration policy. It's about appealing to people who have a very visceral response to brown immigrants. So that gets him applause. That gets him coverage. That makes him feel good.
But there are little. I mean, the thing that brings people over is that there are kernels of truth
sure. right.
in all of these things, right? In interest rates and inflation went up dramatically after his presidency.
But his numbers were wrong.
Oh, yeah. No. That's
he wasn't
right.
even close like on the economy.
I mean, you know, 60%. No, it was only 20%.
Groceries up 57%.
He's right. been so many times fact-checked and proven wrong that people don't even pay attention.
No,
right?
I understand that.
But wait, people need, you know, everyone's, well, you know, it's all baked in. People don't care anymore because they know it's just him being him. We got to stop that. It's not, he's creating, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's okay.
He's creating this fake image.
He's
normalizing lies.
Yeah.
And he's, not only does he do it impromptu, he has lies written down in his speech. They are normalizing a legacy for him that didn't exist. And they're lying about a legacy of the Biden administration, right? And we can't allow that normalizing.
But I think it already is. I think that train has left the station.
Yeah, that left in 2016.
If people want to criticize him for saying, you know, I was closing the border and then it reopened, well, there were changes in policy that caused a flood and a lot of other reasons that caused a flood mm-hmm. of immigration across the border. Did it cause more crime? I mean, probably on a numerical basis, maybe because there's more people here. But on a percentage basis, I think it's mm-hmm. well established that immigrants have a lower incidence of committing
Correct.
Crimes. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's partial facts and partial truths that lend an air of credibility to what he's saying. Well, and the vast majority of people are not going to fact check it. They are not going to pay attention to the media sources that they're not already tuned into. So I think we need a better candidate on the other side is the bottom line.
Well, and that's what I was going to get to. But I mean, the glossing over, I was struck last night by the, you know, the tourists coming in from Iowa, coming mm-hmm. into New York mm-hmm. or into Washington and being gunned down and murdered and so forth. So but my reaction to your point, Teresa, I mean, you keep saying, you know, this is all baked in. Well,
no, I say people say it's big.
No,
I
say it's big, but it shouldn't be. But at that debate, it all goes back to that debate. I mean, obviously mm-hmm. it doesn't, but let's use that as an example. Those are the times where right. Joe Biden should have jumped in and said, no, bum, 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 bum. And that never happened. And then and inexplicably in the next 3 weeks that hasn't mm-hmm.
yeah.
happened.
Yes.
And so that's to Heather's point of bringing us back to full circle of what the Democrats do and coming up with a candidate, perhaps, if he decides to leave the race, that can win, but is also articulate in bringing up those issues. I got to go to a break, but go ahead.
Okay, I just want to add one thing, which is the issues that he's pointing to, crime, immigration, and inflation, are issues that people have a real problem with
Absolutely.
Right now. And he's raising them and saying, aggressively, I am going to fix them, and I fixed them before, you know, and it wasn't a problem when I was here.
That's what politicians but at
right.
the same, do.
Right. Right. And, yeah, and, exactly. and that is not what we heard from Biden, you know, I that's just.
But whoa, wait a minute. At the same time, he says, I'm going to fix it. He doesn't say how.
Nope.
You have Project 2025. That says how. And then you have the House Appropriations Committee, how they're fixing it. They're cutting deeply in the Justice Department budget. They are cutting, you know, all of these programs. It's he says, I'm going to fix it. They're slashing budgets right
so,
now in the House because they're following Project 2025. And what does he say? Oh, nothing to see there. Let's do, you know, that's not us. And even John Faso yesterday. Oh, you know, I hear nothing. I see nothing. I didn't even look at Project. Are you kidding me? It's the fingerprints are all over the legislation. It's all over the speech. I'm going on and on.
No, you're all right. I was just going to say, if only we could like suck all of this out of your brain and then share it with everyone. You know what I mean? Like, how do you get my point is, how do you get that out to the people?
What's Project 2025?
Well, no. How do you get what you are saying? You are getting into the nitty gritty here of the House and their voting and so forth.
Yeah, presidential elections people, are people not about
don't,
details.
People don't yeah, care. People, policy. What people heard last night is they're going
to. I'm go. Strong. His message is, I'm strong. Democrats weak.
Yep. I'm strong. God save
God
me.
God save me.
I'm I going to fix all the problems
God
that are
me
making
so
you
so I can save you.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And that's why Joe Biden needs to be out there and countering this. And
but
he's not.
But we all do. The
House
members, the Senate
Biden
members, everybody.
You need a person.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, you need
The roundtable's not sufficient.
We're not going to get it done. Sorry.
But that's going to work itself out. And then the Democrats have to stop whining at the margins and just focus. Get it done.
I am not
Get
confident
it done.
About it working itself out in a way that, by contrast, doesn't look ugly, disorganized, chaotic. Yeah. And that's a big concern.
I agree with you, although I don't know how we could get any more chaotic than what we've got
that's
right
true.
Now.
And you don't think that speech last night was chaotic? That was
yes,
crazy. That was crazy town.
Okay, so let's take a break.
I'll keep talking, but we can. You know I will.
You
all through the
ever tried Valium? we'll be right back. You can hold on to your crown. What was lost is now sound. You can hear the song of freedom, the gorgeous song of freedom. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Judith Enck, Aaron Bassetti, Heather Mulligan, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We just have about 5 minutes or so before we go to the news because we went a little long there because we were exploding.
Fired up, ready to go.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Let's see. Joanne writes, thank you for Teresa and Judith for mentioning Project 2025 S45's policy plan. More please, the word needs to get out. And we've obviously discussed this a lot, and we will continue, I am sure. We got this from Jill. Since the assassination attempt, Trump was low-key and spoke of God saving him. I had hoped this was his come-to-Jesus moment. The first half of the speech gave me more hope. So much for being hopeful. Then we go to more people and students in this country have been killed by white men with AR-15s than by illegals. You could make the case that white men born in America are more dangerous than people who enter our country illegally, and that from Richard.
I thought it was really strange during J.D. Vance's speech how he was kind of mocking his deceased grandmother for having 19 guns in her house when his running mate was almost killed by an AR-15. And no discussion about guns other than praising guns during the convention.
Yeah, I also think it's interesting that they talk about fentanyl and how it's one
fentanyl?
Of the fentanyl. Thank you.
Yep.
One of the leading killers, which is true, and they should be talking about it. But the leading killer of young people right now is guns.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to talk about how we need to solve the leading problem that's killing our children, then they need to talk about guns. But they're not going to do that.
What did we not hear from the president last night?
Abortion. Didn't mention the word abortion.
No.
Did not mention.
Or women. Anything that could even be perceived as.
And it wasn't just him. It was the whole 4 days
right.
of it.
And let's not forget who else hasn't mentioned abortion in the past 3 weeks either.
Well, he hasn't mentioned anything.
I know.
Yeah. Oh,
this
that's
is the
point.
Complete and total failure.
Oh. That's just not true.
Biden has not.
When
been
Harris given Harris
has
abortion?
He has
issues.
Talked about it over
in
and over again,
weeks.
And Harris has done 5 or 6 events on it.
She's not the presidential. She's not the Democratic nominee
yet.
She's the vice president. She's out campaigning on that issue. She did 3 or 4 forums on it. She was in Kalamazoo, Michigan, in a conservative swing state.
I mean, but even you have to admit, Teresa, that the campaign. The Biden campaign has come to a grinding halt.
He's talking about mental acuity tests, not issues.
And where was their response to last night?
Yes.
Was there a Biden response?
I mean, there were a couple press releases. In between, like, I'm sorry that Bob Newhart died. But yes, there were. Real quick, we have two letters. I'm so tired of hearing you all talk out of both sides of your face. You are the Democrats whining at the margins, and you're faulting Biden for not having spent the last 3 weeks countering Trump's lies. But because of people like you, he's had to spend the last 3 weeks simply defending his right to be the nominee. It's the media that's going to lose this election for the Democrats, not Biden, says Jane.
Jane, it's the polls that and the voters that have made it very clear, not just over the past 3 weeks, but over the past 3 years, that they don't like Biden. And that's even amongst Democrats.
Well, I mean,
Democrats
have
lost this opportunity.
I will say that I do think that Biden has been out and about. I think that the hour-long press conference, Trump could not have come close to doing a press conference that he did post-NATO conference, the depth of his knowledge, the discussion. And he made one mistake. Everybody focused on the one mistake. They didn't focus on the whole thing. You know, Trump couldn't have come close to doing what Biden did. And then Biden was out in a number of other places. Every time he slips up on a word, they miss it. He was out.
But that's not going to go away.
Right.
That's the
problem.
No,
I'm not saying. Yeah. I've long said it needs to shift. Yeah. But to say that he hasn't been anywhere, he hasn't been talking, is not true. And he has been covered differently than Trump.
Okay. Carrie says, I'm going to end with this. Deborah actually says, how I love Teresa. She loves baseball. She loves the Apollo moon landing. And she loves America. Thank you, Carrie.
That's so sweet.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue and we will move on. We have a bunch of other stuff to talk about. We have more letters. We have lots coming up. We're going to go another round here. We'll take a break. First news with Ray Graff.
Every time you walk by, just like me, they long to be close to you.
I said no. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Judith Enck, Aaron Pacitti, Heather Mulligan, and Teresa Bourgeois. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So, knowing what we know, that the president seems to be, according to reporting, is more receptive to talking about the possibility of leaving the race. Who among you thinks that will actually happen?
I think it will, but it has to happen fast.
Hustle up, yeah.
I think
TikTok.
Over the past couple weeks, I'm staying in the race, to seeing that story this morning that he's open to it was a sea change in what's happening in the inner circle of the Biden camp. And to me, that is it's just a matter of time at this point.
So when you think, and Teresa, you agree?
Yeah, but I'll reiterate what I've said before, but I'm staying in the race. No matter who it is, you're all in until you're not. And he needed to say that. Just remember, at an international NATO summit, he should not have said he wasn't all in. And I think it's a matter of time, and they needed to do some polling. You've seen the polls leak out in the last few days. They've done the polling that they needed to do. They have to think through the money stuff. They've taken time to do that. They have to think through how you would do the shift. They have this looming August 7th date for Ohio. This has to be resolved. The ticket has to be resolved by August 6th because the filing deadline for Ohio is August 7th. And, I mean, it's not going to be resolved at the convention. It has to be resolved by August 6th. And so
there's a strategic play in the delay, which I know was problematic in terms of, like, let's move on with an actual campaign.
Our sanity?
It's to what Teresa said, and that is there's a lot of back channels in terms of, like, aligning donors, getting delegates, understanding the actual nuts and bolts of how policy works for having an unprecedented historical event.
It should not
change.
Be.
So, like, he's all in, and he has to say he's all in, but that buys time for the people behind the scenes to facilitate a transition to a different candidate that looks and is as orderly as possible.
Well, I'm just going to say I have no confidence that there is an organized, strong coalition in support of an alternate candidate. And I think that is a big problem. I mean, I think, you know, the assumption that it would be Harris because she's the heir apparent, there's a lot of people pushing back on that. A lot of folks who think that her polling numbers are roughly the same as his, that she has the same problems in the swing states that he has. So that opens the door for an alternate candidate. And I don't think there's any consensus around any one individual. And there is no time. You know, the money thing, setting aside the money thing, because I think that's solvable. You can give the money to PACs and spend it through different vehicles. But you need to have unity, because that's the one thing you saw out of this convention was unity. And Nikki Haley spoke there, you know. And so the idea that there is forgiveness, there's open door, there's tolerance of a variety of viewpoints, all of that, and we're very organized and we can put on a slick show, that message is out there. For the first time in any polling I saw this morning, Trump at 52%. That's over 50%. That is not insignificant. If I was if I was running the Democratic campaign committee, I would be sweating bullets right now because I mean you really
Well, they are, which is one of the reasons they said, "Whoa, you know, you got to understand. It's not to do what they're about to do is not easy. It should not be easy because people voted. I mean, it's a process thing that should not be, you know, it should be doable. And it has, you know, but it should not be easy, and it's not easy, and you need to think through the substance of it.
So I want to talk about a very important issue of this campaign, and that, of course, is the economy. You alluded to this earlier, Teresa, and it just so happens we have an economist here. And I know Teresa has a lot of questions. I know Heather wants to get in on this. I know Judith wants to get in on this, so I'd like to just set up this conversation, which is twofold. One is that the reporting, there was a New York Times story about tax cut and increased tariffs that could hurt poorer households, and Republicans want to use revenue collected from higher duties on foreign goods to finance tax cuts. And economists say such a shift could widen the gap. There was also an opinion piece in the Washington Post that takes a look at Trump's economy versus Biden's economy, and they looked at it in 17 charts. We can't do that on the radio, but we have Aaron.
Yeah.
Biden has delivered an impressive recovery, says the piece, but many voters remember lower prices under Trump. So I leave you at it.
There's three things that are worth pointing out about the economic platform and the discussion around economics in this campaign. And the first is that you can't compare the Trump economy to the Biden economy because it was interrupted by COVID. So that's like comparing apples to oranges, right? Like, of course, inflation was lower under Trump, but unemployment on average was higher, not because of Trump's policies, but because COVID happened. So then in the same breath, you can't compare high inflation under Biden to low inflation under Trump because, you know, 90% of inflation that's happened after the pandemic was driven by supply chain snarls, shifting spending patterns, global lockdowns and supply chain disruptions, which created spikes in the price of used cars, Putin's invasion of Ukraine, which interrupted worldwide grain exports, the distortion in housing markets, which makes up 40% of spending. None of that is Biden's fault. But, and I think you would all agree with me, it doesn't matter. Voters don't care whether it's COVID-related or whether it's Biden's fault. Of course, Trump is going to say, well, it's Biden's fault. You can look at this, that, and that, and blah, 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 blah. And voters will probably likely believe that because inflation does pinch them in the wallet and pocketbook. So that's the first thing, is that making a comparison to the piece that Joe alluded to with the 17 graphs, it's not fair. It doesn't tell a coherent story. The second part, which I think is more helpful, and that is actually not looking in the past to try to explain, well, why did what happened in the past happen, but what's going to happen in the future? Trump has laid out, and Project 2025 has laid out, a coherent economic agenda. So the second fallacy, and you heard this last night, Trump's going to bring prices down. Okay, that's a term called deflation. And deflation is the opposite of inflation. It's when the price of goods and services and the cost of living fall from year to year. Well, the only way economies can achieve deflation is by pushing unemployment up to double-digit levels, which would create negative wage growth. With negative wage growth, businesses have to lower prices because people don't have enough income to buy them. There have been the only period where the U.S. economy has sustained significant deflation or decreases in the cost of living was during the Great Depression. Do we want to repeat that to lower prices? So Trump's talking about lowering prices. There's no way he can do that without engineering a second Great Depression. Now, he says, so the third issue is, well, what are his policies and what does that look like? I cannot stress this enough. The policies Trump is advocating, a reduction in immigration, tariffs on imported goods, a 10% tariff across the board on imported goods and a 60% tariff on Chinese-made goods, more tax cuts, and meddling with the Federal Reserve, all of those will increase inflation further. Reducing immigration, which is not to say it's not a valid policy objective. You can argue for it. The point is that if you reduce immigration, you will reduce the labor supply, you will put upward pressure on wages, and that will lead to inflation. Immigrants, both documented and undocumented immigrants, tend to work in food service and agriculture. So when all of a sudden that supply of labor dries up, the high grocery prices that consumers are complaining about all of a sudden gets worse. So immigration will reduce labor supply, and that'll push up inflation. His tariff policy, tariffs and taxes get passed on to consumers. Businesses might eat a fraction of the cost of higher tariffs by accepting lower profit margins, but it's in the second chapter of every introduction economics textbook. Taxes get passed on to consumers. So a 10% across the board tariff and a 60% tax on Chinese tariffs is going to raise the prices of imports, not just for consumers in the clothes we buy, in the food we buy, but also for producers who depend on imported steel and imported computer chips. So,
and that happened in the last when he was in office the last time, right?
Yeah. So we didn't see the inflation bump because it was a little scattershot. It's going to be a little more coherent this time. He's talking about another round of tax cuts, and that – I don't want to sound too wonky. Deficit finance tax cuts or deficit finance government spending will lead to higher inflation. It's – if you just cut taxes and decrease government tax revenue, that's going to raise government borrowing costs, which drives up interest rates and drives up inflation. It's a theory that economists call crowding out. So when you have rising deficits during a period of full employment like we have now, you're going to see higher interest rates and higher inflation. Trump has also mentioned, and this is part of Project 2025, is to starting to introduce political calculations into Federal Reserve policy. The Federal Reserve is historically and notoriously independent because they're the ones who do all of the dirty work that politicians don't want to do. They raise interest rates to control inflation because politicians don't want to raise taxes or cut spending to accomplish the same goal. The Fed ensures stability in financial markets. They have the interest of the macro economy above, you know, politics. So, you know, Trump says, well, you know, I'll keep Jerome Powell provided he does continues to do a good job. If political meddling be in the Federal Reserve, whether it's through bullying, whether it's through legislating it, will make the Federal Reserve kind of just the economic arm of the executive branch. So politicians are going to say, cut interest rates to make the economy grow. And when the economy grows, that'll look better for us because we can say unemployment's down. But the byproduct of economic growth and low unemployment is higher inflation. So all of Trump's policies, independent of what he says, will lead to higher inflation. And that's something voters just need to know.
So on the deflationary that mm-hmm. conversation, there were a couple things that he said he was going to do that in theory could lower the cost of certain things. In reality, probably not. He said he would, you know, drill, baby, drill, right. return to full exploration, return to energy independence. The argument being, you know, if fuel costs and energy costs go down, they're so essential to the right. production of goods and services, uh-huh. the price of those will go down. That makes a lot of assumptions, right? That assumes right. that if the price of one element of making of a good or service goes down, that the manufacturer is going to cut the price and they're going to cut and
right that savings.
So, and counter to that is the idea of tariffs, right? One of the reasons that we have sometimes low prices, and one of the reasons that American manufacturers have struggled and in many instances have either gone out of business or moved their manufacturing out of the U.S., is because of competition, foreign mm-hmm. competition, yeah. Keeping prices artificially low, mm-hmm. right? You start putting tariffs on goods coming in and component parts coming in. That drives up the price, that allows the price to be higher on our side. Right. So it does not actually have the effect of cutting prices right. at the end of the day. The other piece of that is he said, I'm going to take the money from the tariffs and I'm going to use that to lower taxes. The math doesn't work.
Yeah,
the amount of money generated from the tariffs would not accomplish the kind of eliminating the personal income tax scenario right. that was described. But, you know, truth is relative, right, in this context.
No, it's you're right. All of this is built on a lot of fantastical assumptions.
And false assumptions. I mean, just on the energy front, the Biden administration is producing more crude oil than any right. other country in the history of the world, which I think is a bad thing in terms of climate change, even the economics of climate change.
Drill, baby, drill.
Right. And so more heat death, more flooding, more sea level rise, more yep. wildfires that we can't breathe in the summertime. And I just think it was wild that they had a whole night of messaging on drill, baby, drill. Unfortunately, Biden is drilling everywhere and exporting to other countries.
That was another thing that was going to happen in the first day, but yes.
And they said he was stopping all that. But also, what are the economic implications?
No.
He keeps saying that Trump and his folk keep saying that they're going to stop the Green New Deal. They're going to end that legislation. Or they're going to stop all of
the
that
Green
funding.
News scam.
The Green News scam. The Green News scam. But that's generating, that's reshoring some of the manufacturing. I mean, they're
right.
bringing back the solar panels and a whole host of other things because of the incentives they've built in it, right?
The problem is that I want to talk about the drill, baby, drill, and the oil, and then to get to the Green New Deal stuff.
But it's all part of the
right, is
same
that
thing.
Oil is sold in global markets. It's not like the U.S. produces oil and then we, you know, put it in a, you know, we save it just for U.S. consumers. The way mm-hmm. oil is sold, it's sold in global markets. It goes to global refineries, and then that, you know, gets refined and sold as gasoline and heating fuel. And
poisons communities where the refining
so
takes place.
Just because the U.S. is producing more oil, that's, no pun intended, a little drop in the bucket of the global supply of oil. OPEC could just as easily offset mm-hmm. that increase in production mm-hmm. with a decrease in production because they don't like what we're doing in the Middle East, right? So there's a lot of ways that drill, baby, drill might not produce lower fuel prices. Talking about the Green New Deal, one of in terms of making American industries more globally competitive. Tariffs are one way to do that, except that it usually doesn't work out that way because the country on the other end retaliates by
trade wars.
Becomes a trade war,
yeah.
So it's a lose-lose proposition. So what Biden has done is the flip side, and that is instead of taxing it, you subsidize domestic production.
Right.
So with the CHIPS Act,
and the
Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, with
the
Inflation Reduction Act, all of that. If you want to reduce energy costs, you subsidize renewables because that technology is there and it's substantially cheaper than relying on fossil fuels. So that would, in the long run, it wouldn't happen next year, right? The time scale of this is a multiple year, probably a decade plus. But there needs to be a long-term vision for that. And
it's happening today in terms of rates. You know, the states that have the most wind are Texas and Iowa. And unfortunately, Texas can't keep the lights on after hurricanes. I mean, you know, with all of the political drama of the last few weeks, the media has not focused on literally hundreds of thousands of people in Houston were without power and really suffering because they have a standalone grid.
And I'm going to just point to that. I mean, that's why you cannot have a grid that is 100% dependent on intermittent generation, right, which is wind and solar. You need to have base load. Maybe we'll get to the battery technology someday. We are not there yet. But that's, I mean, you
but
need...
But that's not why the lights are out.
Yeah. No, and they haven't invested in hardening their infrastructure, storm hardening, and they don't have redundancy built into the system the way some other states do. But reliability is becoming a problem in New York now, too.
Yeah.
Because of the way that the grid is structured, because of the added costs on building in additional infrastructure to add on distributed generation that is partially subsidized by the rest of the ratepayers. I mean, it's very complicated, but adding in wind and solar costs the ratepayers money initially. Someday, the costs could theoretically go down. But the utility companies don't control the cost of the commodity. They only control the infrastructure costs, the distribution costs. And if you shrink the pie too much, they can't invest.
But the rates are lower now. If you're just looking at the economics, the energy investment that makes the most sense is first energy efficiency.
Right.
Let's use less.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's do heat pumps everywhere. Wind and solar are cheaper than fossil fuel today.
Right. And geothermal.
And one of the reasons is because you don't pay for the sun and you don't pay for the wind. You absolutely do have to have a modern infrastructure. There needs to be improvements with battery storage. And that's why I was so confused. At 12:05 this morning, former President Trump said that Biden administration wasted $9 billion for 8 chargers. Did he mean battery storage? What did he mean by that?
Phone chargers.
EV chargers. He's really fixed.
He was talking about EV. I believe he was talking about electric vehicle charges. And I thought there were individual chargers that he was speaking of.
There's no way. It was $9 billion for 8 chargers.
I made note of that, too. I assume it was a facility, but I don't.
It's a new subject.
I don't know.
He has said some version of it. But all of these are investments in the Inflation Reduction Act. These are all investments in hardening the grid, the strengthening the grid. They're all investments in the battery storage, which we need to get to. I mean, I'll go back to my Cahoes situation where we put in floating solar, and it's being the solar panels are there now. I saw them. That is going to save the city $500,000 a year. So not only is it clean energy, it also will have an immediate impact once it's up and going next year for a very low-income community. And if you replicate this around the country, that's $500,000 you can invest in other things. Same thing with making the buildings more efficient. That's why this infrastructure money that Trump says, it's Biden stuff, he's going to get rid of it. There's a high cost to that. Mm-hmm. There's a high cost to doing that.
So it's a personal anecdote. My wife and I switched to solar in 2014. We got heat pumps installed. It's energy efficient. But there are large upfront costs, even with the subsidies. So the out-of-pocket expense
but
that a lot of
people... But there's more subsidies now.
I'm saying, but in terms of a sensible policy to begin that shift, because like I said, it's not going to happen overnight, requires... to help lower and middle income consumers.
But if you look at what's in the
30-second warning, but go ahead.
Inflation Reduction Act had really significant change for communities. One is community solar incentivizing. The other is for municipalities who could never take advantage of these tax because they don't tax.
And you and I went
too early
on the heat pumps. If we were buying them now, the tax incentives are much better.
Texas, federal government is subsidizing solar in Texas. It's one of the fastest growing solar areas. The state is not, but the federal government is.
I have an idea that if anybody who is in Albany and happens to be driving around, if you came to the station around 3:30 this afternoon, we'll still be in this room arguing.
We're going to a diner after this and keep going.
take it over and keep going. Invite our friends. All right, we have to take a break. We will continue, and we'll do all of that after this news break from the BBC.
Where successes and fakes go to make their mistakes, far away from the cruel public eye.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning. We are going to go into extra innings and take the panel to 11 o'clock this morning.
4 p.m. We're staying till 4.
Yes, I know. We could. You know, there's enough to talk about, certainly. And who knows what today will bring. So there's always that. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. I want to get to a couple letters on the economic discussion that we just had, and then we will move on to other things. So while we're in political purgatory, waiting for Biden to hopefully officially step down, writes Monica, does the panel feel there are some Democratic candidates that are actively preparing going to battle against Donald Trump? If so, what does the panel feel are the strongest areas to argue against Trump to really demonstrate the strength and intelligence of the Democratic Party?
I think voters are desperate for anyone except Biden in the Democratic world. I mean, and this is nothing new. This is for years. Voters have been way ahead of elected officials and pundits saying Biden is too old. And I kind of tuned that out until the debate. So I think, quite honestly, anyone with a pulse, with the exception of Joe Manchin, will be welcomed. And they're going to have a lot of momentum. And there's no shortage of issues that they can campaign on and show the contrast.
I think there's two to get direct. So I want to have a disclaimer that Biden has had one of the most remarkable runs of policy in modern history. I don't in terms of what he's accomplished, that's remarkable. So he's leaving a lot for Democrats to build on. So the first thing they could say is, you know, we've lowered the prices of the top 10 prescription drugs. But, you know, everyday meat and potatoes, pocketbook issue. I wouldn't say meat and potatoes because of grocery prices, but
eggs are down.
Tofu and kale. But it has
abortion.
To, but it
it's
has
abortion.
To be forward-looking. It can't,
right.
It
so
can't
one is
be...
abortion. Trump is vulnerable on that, and voters and a lot of undecided voters are also uneasy with that, no matter who he brings on to the stage at the RNC. It's abortion, abortion, abortion. Don't let him take a breath without thinking about overturning Roe v. Wade. The second thing they Democrats could do is the forward-looking part is saying, listen, COVID was problematic. Trump's tax cuts are primarily going to go to millionaires and billionaires. You're not going to benefit. They could talk about strengthening labor law. They could talk about subsidies for investments in clean energy or
climate
whatever.
Your personal economy. We've worked to lower drug prices. Exactly. We're going to keep it going. We've effectively worked to lower drug prices. We are increasing jobs. We're going to keep it going. We are diversifying jobs. We're bringing more people into the trades.
Right.
We are helping with the education costs. It's all
they need to invert. They need to invert the Trump tax cut and saying there's going to be an increased tax on millionaires and billionaires, and we're going to use that revenue to fund education subsidies, to fund health care subsidies,
to fund
child care subsidies, to fund the Green New Deal initiatives.
Yeah, I mean, I really think what they need to do is take a look. It's not that complicated. Take a look at what are the top issues that people are concerned about. It's inflation, it's affordability, and it's you know, immigration, political stability, crime. So how do you address those issues with a plan? Not a, oh, inflation isn't that bad and it's going down.
Right.
Not a, well, we tried to fix immigration, but the Republicans wouldn't let us. You can't, that is not a plan. A plan is, here's what we're going to do moving forward. That all may be true.
But I do think you could say, you know, once he's out of the way, we had bipartisan consensus on a plan to strengthen the border, and we're going to move that through once he's, you know, and he blocked it. we're going to move it through. But all of these things, like prescription drugs, the things that matter in people's, ensuring more people, we made progress, we're going to keep it going. Infrastructure, getting you clean water, clean air, we keep it going. You know, it's just, we have a good foundation, we're going to keep it going. These are things that matter in your life.
And people are so tired of the divisiveness and the drama, which is why I thought prior to the debate, even though the poll numbers were bad for Biden in many swing states, they're much worse today. I thought Biden had a shot because when people said we don't want all this vitriol and all this hate, well, then how do you vote for Trump, especially if you're an independent in a swing state? Women are quite concerned about reproductive choices, not just abortion, but birth control, for goodness sakes. Have you heard J.D. Vance on women's health issues?
Frightening.
It is the handmaiden's tale. And so,
and have you heard what he thought about Trump? People should listen to that. Anyway.
Right. Well, Vance's speech the other night could have won a Pulitzer for fiction writing in terms of where he has been over the last few years.
I would argue that it was not that well written.
Not well written. Okay. Yeah. The delivery was
the
bad.
Book or the speech?
Anyway. No, well, both.
I know.
I was cleaning out our bookshelves 2 weeks ago, and I had Hillbilly Elegy, and I donated it to the library.
Oh, I want to read it. And I don't want to buy it.
Go to the library. I can get it back probably for you. But it, like, it doesn't.
I thought it was a good book, actually.
But it doesn't matter in terms of what he's saying today.
But
there's no connection to, because he's a changed man.
I want to get to letters, but go ahead.
But what he said, in fact, it gets to the letter that you just read. What Vance said that he's for are not Trump policies. You know, the Biden administration
is. But now it is.
But the things that he was saying, we have to help the average, you know, working person, which his speech was all about. How do we help the average working person? Trump policies aren't going to do that. That's his tax cuts are not going to help the average working person. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Let's. All right. Thank you. Let's go.
Joe, it's your show.
Sorry.
I keep forgetting.
Like, there's a lot of average working people who will say, I was doing better under Trump because it's pre-inflation, because wage growth was outpacing inflation at the time. So, I mean, that's the problem is he can keep pointing back and saying, and now he, don't get me wrong, he exaggerates the heck out of it. I mean, he said 100 times last night, they've never seen anything like it. No one's ever seen anything like it. I had the best economy in the whole world of all of human history. You know, no one has ever seen anything like it. Well, that's not really true. You know, but the fact is, if, you know, saying now that, you know, Biden or a continuation of these policies is going to help the working class feel better, it has to be something different then. It has to be a shift, because what they're feeling is, I'm not getting as much for my money right now. Affordability is a problem.
Yeah, especially housing.
Yeah.
But I think, quite honestly, any Democrat with a pulse, except for Joe Manchin, will take that message. There's no shortage of really good ideas, but we need someone who can communicate and who can go toe-to-toe with Trump when he consistently lies.
Well, Joe wants to communicate
letters.
Their
campaign can't be... Yeah, but he's a liar.
It has to be. Here's what I'm going to do in the future. Joe,
we give you permission to continue.
Dear Joe, I know you're aware, but please, Shoddy Caps, one at a time. They're talking over each other. Thanks for what you're trying to accomplish, but please accomplish it. That's Tony.
Sorry, Tony.
That's all right.
Sorry. You're right.
He actually did say that was a private comment, so I apologize.
We're otherwise pretty good with that, though.
Yeah.
The CNN panels are out of control.
I think
that is such a good point, because you cannot hear when we talk all over each other. You should have heard us during the break, though.
Yeah, really.
Trump doesn't have the answers, but either does Biden, writes Spencer. Trump is right when he says our country is in decline. It is a quantifiable fact. The size of the middle class and the spending power of the middle class has been in decline since the 70s, and neither party has done anything to meaningfully stop it. The has-beens that Trump brought on stage last night, quote-unquote, were from a time in which middle class folks could still reasonably expect to own a home, a car, and afford to send their kids to college with the realistic hope that they would live a life far more comfortable and fulfilling than their own.
Well, Hulk Hogan was popular in the 80s when inflation was substantially higher than it is now. So I don't know.
And interest rates were what? 12, 15, 20?
Yeah, right. 17.5%, I think is what
they couldn't buy a house.
Anyways, that's largely beside the point. I think the letter writer is correct in assuming that economically, the rise in inequality, which is synonymous with the decline and the tightening of the vise on the middle class getting pushed closer and closer to the end of the financial cliff, that's been going on since the late 70s.
Well, income disparity.
Yeah, right.
Income disparity is a big issue.
So
the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer.
You are being so petty, writes Linda. Just like a bunch of seventh grade girls. You too, Joe. I don't like J.D. Vance's book. I don't like his speech. Wah, wah. The man is super intelligent, but soon you'll be talking about his wife. You folks are so low. Except for Heather, who we all love.
Oh, wow. I did like the book. I will say that. I thought the book was way better than the movie.
All right. Why are some people ignoring...
Wait, can we just say, I thought his wife seems very impressive.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I want to learn more about her. She sounds amazing.
Maybe she should be the candidate.
I think his story is pretty incredible. I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know...
Mr. Anti-Elite Yale Law grad.
Impressive, right? If true.
But I think the sort of the shift from what he was saying about Trump before, which aligns with what the philosophies of his book, right? I didn't read his book, but
he's
I read about it.
He's a different person than what he wrote in the book.
It's just if he just is, you know, shift for sake of power, right? Mm-hmm. Presumably.
I do believe that people can change their views. I think that that's fundamental to being a human, right? But this is a big change in views.
Yeah, but 18 months ago, he was referring to Trump as Hitler,
but
pretty openly with his colleagues and friends. And then, I mean, all right, so I want to validate what the letter writer just wrote and keep going on something whiny. Were you just stunned when they showed J.D. Vance's mom, who at the convention, who J.D. Vance has really been trashing his whole career. And then they focused on the mom, and I felt really bad for her.
Oh, I thought, no, I mean, 10 years sober.
I think that's a pretty...
I thought it was
pretty,
yeah,
sweet.
But
yeah.
Everything...
No,
I mean, his whole career has been, my mother neglected me, she was an addict. I'm pleased that she's 10 years sober, but I don't know. That didn't
it's
seem
still
like
his mother,
a,
though. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, the truth of addiction is it destroys lives. And I think that one of the overarching themes of his book is the degree to which the opioid crisis really destroyed families. And the book, a lot of it is about how just the safety net of his grandmother, Meemaw, I think, the military really provided him opportunities that he wouldn't otherwise have. I mean, yes, the book is, I think, very, very raw in describing the issues of having his mother be an addict. But the fact that she's recovered, I mean, I believe in redemption, too. And I think it's awesome that she's there and sober 10 years.
Yeah, I didn't read the book, but I thought the redemption story was moving. And I thought it was good. That I thought was really moving.
Meemaw got a lot of good play in his speech. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I just felt bad for the mom being there, sitting next to Speaker Johnson.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up the show, and we will get some letters. We'll move on to other topics, and we'll find out what is on your mind as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Judith, I know you have to leave, so I thank you very much for being with us, as always. And we'll... we'll try to continue the discourse without you.
Carry on.
Excellent. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, going extra innings. And we'll take it up to 11 o'clock this morning with our panel. Judith did have to leave, but we have Aaron Pasitti, Heather Mulligan, and Teresa Bourgeois with us. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Okay, let's see. I want to get to letters, and They are all over the place, which I like. And so we'll try to put them into some bubble of coherent thought. Marion says, I spent some time YouTubing Josh Shapiro, Gretchen Whitmer, Andy Beshear, Gavin Newsom, Wes Moore. Not only can they explain the issues to voters, they are really inspiring. Any of them would make mincemeat of Trump or Vance in a debate.
I mean, that's possible. Yeah, no, I'm sure there's a lot of Democrats that could. I mean, it doesn't take much to outdo Trump in a debate. You just need to know how to push his buttons and keep derail him, which is not complicated. The question is, fair point. The question is, like, would voters actually get behind any of those candidates, and do any of those candidates want to run?
I think there's a threshold problem issue, which is, what do you do if the nominee is not Kamala Harris? Because you're going to have some blowback, some people who have the expectation that she is the heir apparent. And I think I mentioned earlier, I think her polling numbers are roughly the same as Biden.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She's polling right a little now. Bit better.
Maybe slightly better. But as far as the swing states go, it's really troubling that she would have to really move the dial quite a bit. Now, could she make a really interesting choice with a VP? Someone, I think, perhaps with some foreign policy experience. I think Gabby Gifford's husband is
Mark Kelly.
Mark
Senator,
Kelly's,
is that who I really think
yeah,
is the
I mean,
right
I think
person
he's
on the ticket?
An interesting choice. I think they need to think about Wisconsin and Michigan, because those are states that could theoretically be states that they could pick up that are in the swing states, and that's a Whitmer. That would lean towards a Whitmer, but a two-woman ticket is difficult also, because there just are a certain number. There's a certain percentage of the population say, I don't want two women in charge. Now, do I think that? No. But I think that there are definitely people out there, and that's something they have to be thinking about. So you then have the added problem of very little time for name recognition. There's a lot of people who will vote for celebrity, for I've heard of that guy. Thankfully, Trump's negatives are high enough that he hasn't seen what I think anybody else on the Republican ticket would have gotten a much bigger bump after the debate. But his negatives are so big that I think that is keeping this potentially a competitive race. But they're going to need to spend a lot of money, make us very familiar with who their candidate is, and give confidence to people that they have a handle on foreign policy, on immigration, on crime, and on inflation.
Well, that's one of the reasons I think Mark Kelly would be good on the ticket, is because he's from a border state. He was actively involved in the bipartisan negotiations for the border bill.
Yep.
He certainly has a global view, you know, literally and figuratively. He has the military experience. He knows protocol. He's been deeply vetted, so on and so forth. I think the Vice President Harris issue, that would only work if both she and Congressman Clyburn said it was her choice to stay as VP. And that would be driven by the polling data. And clearly they're doing polling now. So I think that's the kind of thing that's being worked out. And her, you know, she must remain on the ticket, whether she is the top of the ticket or second. I think it doesn't matter. But to your point about Trump, I was interested, even Britt Hume, who's Fox News All In, he was saying last night there's great resistance across the country for Trump. This is what he said after the meeting. And I do think, and I also think that if it is Vice President Harris, if she goes to the top of the ticket, that will be viewed differently in the current climate.
Marion writes about Mark Kelly. We can't spare him in the Senate. We need to win the Senate. And while he isn't very old, he doesn't exude youth, and we need that right now.
He's not up this cycle. In fact, he's out campaigning for other senators, and it's a Democrat who's the governor, and so he'd be replaced by a Democrat.
I feel like I'm seeing history repeat itself, writes Ellen. In 1968, Lyndon Johnson announced at the end of his run for re-election, and Hubert Humphrey took his place as the Democratic candidate for president. Choosing to follow Johnson's policies, Humphrey lost the election, giving us President Richard Nixon with all that brought, until he was forced to step down after the Watergate catastrophe and all the lies that came with that. Please consider the possible outcomes if we force Biden to step down and replace him with Kamala Harris. I do have to say that I don't think
Democratic leadership are making the suggestions, they're showing the polls, but I think it's been very clear that this is the decision of the president of the United States as to whether mm-hmm. he is going to be leaving that race or not.
Right. I mean, I think that exactly her point, though, is what many people have been cautioning. The last time this happened, we ended up with Nixon and so on and so forth.
But Biden runs, he loses.
Right.
Right.
Like,
and so it's better to...
It doesn't matter if he just gives it his all. This isn't a little league game.
Right. You never know for sure because
things
can change in a minute, but the data is pointing in that direction. So the question is, okay,
sure.
do you just, let's just see what else will work here.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a strong record, but we all have to line up. I mean, everybody has to be all in, no whining, just let's go.
Yeah.
Alice is worried about Aaron. Did Aaron finish his excellent lecture before being hijacked?
I don't think I was hijacked. I did.
Yeah, okay, good.
Thank you. I know I said...
Thank you very much. Yeah.
People were supplementing my
lecture. Good lecture. Oh, yes, as always. Assuming that CEOs possibly be so cynical as to reduce costs just a wee bit to help Trump give the illusion that he is capable of reducing prices.
That's a query
for Aaron. Can we assume that CEOs... Could CEOs possibly be so? There's words missing at the beginning there, but I think that's
right.
I
think the question is, could business leaders who are pro-Trump unite and lower prices to, I don't know, make it seem better?
There
are forces that are beyond the inflationary forces beyond the control, not only of any single CEO or business, but even single industries.
Yeah, and there's boards of directors that they answer to. The shareholders have fiduciary obligation to the company. I mean,
no.
All of these are things we could go on and on about, but the answer to that is no.
But I do think we have to be mindful, separate from that, but interrelated, is that Elon Musk is now all in because he's a J.D. Vance guy. And I think because he controls Twitter, the information flow
X.
issues that he has.
It's X.
I'm sorry. Yes. Whatever. This is how I. But I do think it's interesting to see who's lined up behind them. Him, Peter Thiel.
She is Teresa Bourgeois, Heather Mulligan, Aaron Vasidi. That was Judith Henk. Thank you all for being with us. Very nice to have you in conversation. Appreciate it. Have a beautiful weekend. Thank you for being here on a busy day. We'll be back right after this.